Okay, good morning. Once again, thank you all for joining us today for our In Conversation with Call. Hope you're having a wonderful Friday morning. And I'm now going to turn it over to Dean Tomaselli.
Pam, thank you very much. I hope everybody is well, and thank you for joining us today. We're removed even further from the peak of the COVID pandemic and crisis. And we've had more of our community return to campus. Our students who are doing clinical rotations will return to the wards later this week, later next week, and the week following that. And we're getting back to something that looks like more of a semblance of normal activity. We have less than 60 patients with COVID-19 in our health system. That's down from the peak in the beginning of April of about 1,900. So truly, things have changed. We are hoping that there will not be a secondary surge, but we're kind of on the lookout for that as well. What we are doing is making sure that the clinical and basic research components on COVID are truly in full swing. We have developed clusters of investigators, clinical as well as basic investigators, interested in this virus and the disease that it causes, creating what we call collaboratories. So groups of scientists who are interested in looking at different aspects of this disease. These collaboratories not only work together, but they share information in the form of seminars. And again, through the generous support of our benefactors, we've been able to fund a few pilot grants regarding COVID-19. And these really vary and span the gamut from the use of artificial intelligence to better understand the x-radiographic manifestations of this disease in the lung and other places. There are investigators who are studying differences in the immune system between children and adults to better understand what causes the different manifestations of this disease in those groups of patients. And of course, we're in the hunt for even better therapeutics that include small molecules, antibodies, and vaccines. And our guest today is an expert in these areas, and we'll talk a little bit more about therapeutic development. So why don't I cut to the chase and introduce Dr. John Lai, who's a professor of biochemistry at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine. He is an internationally renowned expert studying the immunology of viral diseases. And he's worked and has developed targeted therapeutics to treat a variety of different viral diseases. And at the time of the COVID pandemic, his lab pivoted to work on this particular problem, both in the development of therapeutics and trying to understand some of the biology of SARS-CoV-2, hopefully leading to the development of vaccines and other therapeutics. So, John, thank you very much for joining us today. We look forward to your comments.
Okay, thank you, Gordon. So hello, everybody. It's nice to meet you, I guess at least virtually. That's the way we meet these days. So I wanted to, again, begin by thanking you for your interest and also thank Dean Tomaselli and the administration again for all of the continued support of our work. I've been at Einstein for 13 wonderful years, and it's a truly unique place for doing biomedical research and for training the next generation of biomedical scientists. So my group is interested in isolating, studying, and engineering antiviral antibodies as potential therapies. And we're also interested in finding ways to induce antiviral antibodies using something like a vaccine. But just before I get into the specifics, one distinction I'd like to make is the difference between a vaccine and a therapeutic. A therapeutic, like an antibody, is something that you would provide to someone after they've been infected to try to stem the infection and prevent it from getting worse. A vaccine is something that induces a particular type of antibody response, one that we would call protective, in someone who has not yet been exposed to the virus. So you would give a vaccine to someone ahead of time so that they would never get infected to begin with. And so now back to antibodies for a second. There's been a lot of discussion in the media about antibody tests. So you probably already know that antibodies are natural immune proteins that help your body fight off infections. Over the years, researchers have figured out how not only to isolate naturally occurring antibodies, but also use molecular biology techniques to generate improved antibodies. Antibodies are really great molecules to consider as therapies. These therapies are called immunotherapies because they tend to be highly specific and have very few off-target effects, which means they generally have a very favorable safety profile. Also, antibodies have what we would call a long half-life, meaning that the antibody, once delivered to the body, stays in the bloodstream for 2 weeks or even longer. This is a huge advantage when using antibodies to combat things like viruses, because it means that the antibody can be given ahead of time or even as the infection first starts, and then it stays and protects the body for quite a while afterwards. For antibody therapies against cancer, this long half-life is also a bonus because it means patients need fewer, less frequent doses. Now, how do you get an antibody? Well, there are a number of different ways to isolate antibodies, and my group is specifically interested in methods that allow us to get a single, what's called a single purified clone, so a monoclonal antibody. Now, you've probably heard in, about convalescent plasma therapy, which is being used for COVID-19. The convalescent plasma therapy uses what we would call a polyclonal antibody from a donor who has survived the virus to try to treat somebody who has an active infection. In a polyclonal antibody therapy, you have many different types of antibodies in the mix. Some that are hopefully good and help fight off the virus, and others that may not do anything, or even some that may be not so great therapeutically. So the analogy I like to use is when you're doing polyclonal antibody therapy, it's sort of like using a machine gun. You're shooting a lot of bullets at the virus, a lot of different antibodies, and hoping that some hit the target. The monoclonal antibody, which is what we focus on, in contrast, is a single, very well-defined antibody that you've selected for optimal features like antiviral activity. Sort of like shooting a single silver bullet, you know, that you know will destroy the virus. That silver bullet can have many advantages, such as a stronger therapeutic activity, better safety profile, and can be easier to manufacture at large scale. The traditional way to get monoclonal antibodies is a technology called hybridoma, where you take B cells, which are the natural immune cells that produce the antibody in the body, and then immortalize them by fusing them with a myeloma cell line. Now, you need to immortalize the B cells because they don't grow well in laboratory petri dishes. So traditionally, hybridomas have been derived from mice, which results in a mouse antibody. Now, this approach, the hybridoma approach, has been the mainstay of industry for many years, but it has a lot of issues. So we have been working on different methods. So one method that we like quite a bit is called phage display. In this method, we use something called a bacteriophage, which is a small virus that is specific for an innocuous lab bacteria, to display a large collection of antibodies, millions or billions of sequences. We call that collection a library. That library can then be quickly screened for antibodies that have the ability to engage or bind the target of interest, so the viral glycoprotein, for example. The huge advantage of this phage display technique is that you can screen a lot of antibodies, as I said before, millions or billions of antibodies. And often, the more antibodies you look through, the better your chances of finding a real winner. It's sort of, I guess, if I were to draw an analogy, it's like thinking about the TV show American Idol. If you start with thousands of auditions, and then you whittle down to one or two stars, that's great. But if you don't have a lot of people auditioning at the beginning, then you may not have that many singers to choose from. In the end, you might end up with someone like William Hung. I don't know if you remember him. He's that funny guy who kind of went viral, who had an awkward dance and covered Ricky Martin's song. So it's really best to start with a large number of people that audition and then select out a star like Kelly Clarkson. So identifying antibodies is similar in that you want to have a very large number of starting clones, and then eliminate ones that don't work well or have issues to arrive at one magical antibody. This would be your silver bullet. The inventors of phage display were awarded the 2018 Nobel Prize in Chemistry. We've used this method to identify new immunotherapies, as Dean Tomaselli mentioned, for emerging viruses such as Sudan virus, which is a member of the Ebola virus family. This Sudan virus therapy is currently being developed as a therapeutic by our commercial partners. We're using this approach as well to identify new antibodies against the SARS coronavirus too. By the way, phage display can also be used to engineer, or can be used to engineer all types of proteins, not just antibodies. And so we are also using it to engineer new, what we call immunogens for dengue or Zika virus as vaccines. So in this case, rather than engineering the antibody, we're engineering part of the virus to be an immunogen. This is a protein that when injected into an animal or maybe someday a human can coax the person's immune system into developing an antibody response that looks very much like an antiviral response, but without ever having exposed that animal or person to the virus. Those antibodies would then protect that animal or human in the event that they ever encountered the real virus and therefore could be considered a vaccine. Dengue and Zika viruses are spread by mosquitoes and are prevalent in many parts of the world where they cause significant disease. Dengue alone causes 400 million infections per year. A particular issue with dengue and Zika viruses is that antibodies, which normally protect against the virus, can, in some cases for dengue and Zika, make the disease worse by a phenomenon that's called antibody-dependent enhancement. So a really important goal for dengue and Zika vaccine research is to find vaccines that induce the right type of antibody, the ones that protect against the virus, and not the ones that cause this antibody-dependent enhancement. And so we've been using phage display to engineer dengue and Zika virus immunogens to act as better vaccine candidates. Okay, so now back to discovering antibodies. So another approach for identifying antibodies is called single B-cell sorting. Here, the idea is to capitalize on the knowledge that that people who have survived a particular virus probably have antibodies in the bloodstream that can destroy the virus. So what we do is sample the blood of these so-called convalescent patients, and then use a technique called fluorescence-activated cell sorting to identify B cells that bind to part of the virus that we produced in the lab. So this would be the glycoprotein. We then rescue the genetic information encoding the antibody from that B cell, and then use that genetic information to produce the antibody in the lab laboratory cell lines. The advantage of this approach, the B cell sorting approach, is that since you're coming from a human, the antibody that you isolate has a human framework, meaning it's of human origin. And that is much less susceptible to having issues of tolerance if it's used as a therapeutic in humans, because it's not recognized, wouldn't be recognized as a foreign species the way an antibody that's derived from a mouse hybridoma, for example, would be. Another advantage is that by studying antibodies from a human survivor, you get some insights into what that person's immune system did in order to let them get over the virus. And this tells you what sort of immune response is desirable in a human to fight off or prevent infection. You can then use this information to design an immunogen or vaccine that it could induce a similar type of antibody, sort of like the immunogens that we just discussed for dengue and Zika. So studying naturally occurring human antibodies allows us to simultaneously develop therapeutics and gain information for designing vaccines at the same time. We've used this B-cell sorting approach to identify potent antibodies against a mosquito-spread pathogen called chikungunya virus that causes a very painful arthritis. Chikungunya is globally distributed but really affects subtropical regions. But one very unique quality of the Einstein and Montefiore is the diverse patient population right here in the Bronx. And so patients we sampled for this project lived in the Bronx but were of Dominican descent and had traveled to the Dominican Republic to visit family where they contracted the virus. They then came back to the Bronx where we were able to sample their blood to develop these antibodies. This is really a situation that wouldn't have occurred if it were not for the very unique patient demographic of the Bronx. We then used the B-cell sorting method to develop antibodies against chikungunya virus, which are exploring as immunotherapeutics, and we're using this method as well to develop antibodies against the SARS coronavirus. And then finally, the last thing I want to tell you about is once you have these antibodies, you may want to see if you could do a little better, if you could maybe improve upon nature's design. And so for this, we use a technology called bispecific antibody engineering. This is a method whereby you essentially combine the activities of two different antibodies into a single antibody. And so you might ask, why do you want to do this? Well, for viruses, there are a couple of big advantages. So the first advantage is that, as we know, viruses tend to evolve very rapidly, meaning they accumulate mutations on their co-proteins very quickly. And so there's always the risk that a virus will escape an antibody or any other type of therapy with just a single random or by chance mutation in the part of the virus that contacts or touches the mAb, the antibody or therapy, and makes it so that the antibody or therapy no longer is able to engage the virus. However, a bispecific antibody hits the virus in more than one place. And so it is not as susceptible to viral escape, because in order to escape the bispecific antibody, the virus would need to mutate in at least two different spots at the same time. Another virus advantage is that the bispecific antibody can bind two different parts of the virus at the same time, or you could engineer it to hit not only the virus, but also a part of the host cell that the virus needs in order to infect. This is sort of to get sort of an augmented effect. This would sort of be like a 1-2 punch for the virus. And we've taken this approach for Ebola virus, chikungunya virus, influenza, and we're doing it now for SARS coronavirus as well. And so thank you very much for your attention. I just wanted to give you that short synopsis, and I'm looking forward to answer any questions that might be asked.
So, John, thank you very much for talking to us about the development of these antibody therapeutics. What have you found thus far that is unique about SARS-CoV-2 compared to some of the other viruses that you've worked on, and how has that influenced your approach?
You know, one of the things I think that's very clear is that there is one sort of extreme site of susceptibility on the virus. And so part of the complication with trying to develop these antibody therapeutics is that, of course, you know, an antibody can or cannot have potent antiviral activity. It really depends on where it binds. And one of the things I think that's very striking about coronavirus is that there's this one area of the protein called the receptor binding domain that if you hit it with, you know, just about anything, you can prevent the virus from getting into the cell. And the receptor binding domain is sort of the key on the virus that inserts into the lock on the cell that allows the virus to get into the cell. And so if you, you know, prevent the key from going into the lock, then you can prevent the virus from going into the cell. Now, other viruses, I think, have these sort of sites of susceptibility, but they might be a little bit more cryptic in other viruses. Now, I think the question is, you know, we know the site of susceptibility. Does it mean it's going to be easier to block coronavirus with some sort of therapeutic directed at the receptor binding domain? I'm not sure. We'll have to wait and see how that goes.
Yeah, so that was my next question, is how do you think that influences either the development of a therapeutic or, in fact, the vaccine? I've asked all of our basic scientists who've thought about this what do you believe the prospects are for having not a vaccine, because there are several in development now, but an effective vaccine in the near term?
You know, it seems that, you know, if you look at the history, I guess, of different vaccines, and especially pertaining to neutralizing antibody, the ones that have been most recalcitrant to vaccine design are the ones that where it's very challenging to induce neutralizing antibodies. So an example, as you know, as you're well familiar with, is HIV. HIV is extremely diverse virus, and so there are only so many sites of susceptibility that are really broad sites of susceptibility for antibodies. And so in order to induce that very, very magical type of antibody that will prevent all different types of HIV infections, people have to go to great lengths to try to engineer the immunogens based on the glycoprotein. So I think that the hope would be that since we know already that there's this very particular site of susceptibility on the SARS coronavirus, that we could leverage that information to quickly find a way to induce neutralizing antibody. And it does seem so far like the studies that are underway that if you use the entire glycoprotein of the coronavirus, so that's the whole exterior spike protein, that you can induce antibodies to that site of susceptibility, the receptor binding domain. Now, another question I think would be, could we improve the response? So could we really focus it on that site of susceptibility? And so I think that will be something to look for in the future. But the fact that you can induce neutralizing antibody, and it seems that, you know, in other studies that we're doing with Kartik Chandran, that people who get infected easily make neutralizing antibody to the virus, makes me optimistic that it's not so much if we can induce a protective response, it's just if we could do it with the right sort of timing and do it with the durability so that it lasts long enough to be a useful vaccine.
Great. So we've also heard recently about the effectiveness of steroids for the treatment of this disease. What can you talk a little bit about steroid therapy and what it's doing and what it's doing with respect to the immune response to these viruses?
Right. So any sort of viral disease, the immune system, of course, is your friend. In many cases, though, that you know, as the disease gets worse, the immune system can also be your enemy because in a lot of cases, what leads to the sort of mortality is not just the fact that a person is infected, but the fact that the person has been infected and their immune system just sort of goes crazy, I guess I would call it, trying to fight off this virus. And that can lead to a type of response called a cytokine storm. Now, something like Ebola, which we've studied for many years, that's really the predominant way that people end up succumbing to the virus, is that there's just so much virus in the bloodstream by the end that the immune system just goes crazy. And it's really the effects of this cytokine storm, which is the immune system sort of ravaging the body, that that cause the complications that ultimately lead to sort of, you know, these a fatal event, I guess I would say. So with the steroids, of course, the steroids really tamp down some of this huge immune response and maybe just help the body get through that sort of period without sort of this, you know, getting into a severe respiratory distress or other sorts of situations that that might ultimately lead to death. And so I think that not just for coronavirus, but also for other viruses, I think that that's a very reasonable approach.
So clearly, antibodies of various types are effective for treatment of these viruses. What are the other applications that you've been thinking about for the use of monoclonal antibodies or bifunctional antibodies and other human disease?
Right. So antibodies are used in a lot of different diseases. I think the most dominant one, I guess maybe pre-COVID, the most dominant one was oncology. I still think that that's a really exciting area, the idea of treating a tumor with antibodies. So far, it's been more successful for liquid tumors. So these are tumors, these would be cancers of blood cells. A difficulty or a challenge for all of us as scientists is to figure out how to get antibodies to be more effective against solid tumors, because antibodies are a little bit bigger than small molecules, so they don't get into, they can't penetrate a tumor, a solid tumor mass as effectively as a small molecule. Another area that we're particularly interested in is the potential for using antibodies for a neurological disease, and I think this is sort of the unexplored territory, which I think will be very exciting over the next 20 or 30 years, because there's sort of an added challenge when you want to use an antibody for, say, something like Alzheimer's. We have a project in this. You know, the idea would be to remove the toxic substance that causes Alzheimer's from the brain before it ever really causes any sort of damage to the brain. But there's a real challenge there in that there's this barrier that the body has set up, rightly so, to sort of protect the brain from you know, anything that might be going on in the rest of the body. This is this barrier that's called the blood-brain barrier. And so in order for the antibody to work in any sort of neurological indication, you have to find a way to let the antibody into the blood-brain barrier so it can do its job. And so I think that, you know, the power of the antibody is really remarkable. And I think if we could find a way to solve that problem, that would really be a game changer for those sorts of diseases.
So very broad applications in a number of human diseases, which is really exciting. I guess the final question I would have is that what do we do in terms of creating an infrastructure that more quickly can develop therapeutics for emerging pandemic viral diseases, and how would that look? I mean, we certainly have a lot of information very quickly about viruses that pop up in various parts of the world. What kind of infrastructure and what kind of infrastructure would we, I know we have some of this at Einstein already, but that we would like to kind of enhance to be even better at intervening early on to prevent what was really just a devastating disease for our community in terms of surveillance and therapeutics development and vaccine development?
Yeah, thanks for the question. So, you know, Einstein Montefiore is very, very well positioned. And I think one of the main, I guess, sort of or assets, if you will, is that it has this very diverse population throughout the Bronx. And so I think one of the particular advantages is that in terms of patient samples, you know, Einstein and Montefiore are really in a great place to help identify people immediately. As an example, for the coronavirus, the infectious disease doctor that we work with, Johanna Daly, was able to identify people that were in the initial New Rochelle index cluster. So that's very quick because New Rochelle is only about 15 minutes away from Einstein. In other cases, like viruses that may emerge from subtropical regions, without a doubt, those viruses would be a population in the Einstein community, Einstein Montefiore patient community, to identify patients that had become convalescent against those viruses because of the demographic of the and sort of the diversity of the backgrounds of the people in the Bronx. So I think in terms of the types of people that we could get as patients to help us get samples from which we could derive antibodies, I think that's in place. And I would say Einstein and Montefiore are particularly strong in that area. I think where we could use a little help, of course, is in the mechanics of scaling up the rapid response, which requires things like robots. At the moment, you know, a lot of the work that the graduate students do is fairly repetitive, could easily be done by, you know, a robot, which would allow the students to do more of the kind of critical experiments that really help accelerate moving things along. So I guess that would be sort of the main infrastructure challenge for speeding things up.
That's terrific. John, thanks so much for taking the time today. This was really insightful, and I want to thank everybody for joining us on the call today. Have a great weekend, and I hope to speak to all of you next week. Thank you.
Thank you.